Welcome to the Deep Dive. We dig into the sources you send our way, pull out the core insights, and, well, give you that concentrated understanding.
It's straight to the point.
So today, we're jumping into the cockpit of an A-1 Skyraider pilot over Vietnam. We're really focusing on the experiences of Gordy Fornell, based on episode 18 of the Military Tales YouTube channel.
Ah, Gordy's story. Yeah, that's a good one.
Right. Our mission here is to really get a feel for those combat flights, understand how this special squadron, the Zorros, came together, and just sense that camaraderie he talks about, you know, the stuff forged in war.
Absolutely. It's a unique perspective, getting it straight from someone who lived it.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. How did Gordy even get into flying A-1s? His path wasn't exactly straightforward, was it?
No, not at all. It's actually kind of fascinating. He came in through ROTC at Michigan State, trained on F-86s, probably thinking fighter pilot track.
Yeah, makes sense.
But bam, first assignment, B-52s, Strategic Air Command, totally different world.
Wow, B-52s. That's a shift. Man. How long was he in SAC?
5 years. Flew the buff through some pretty tense times, too, like the Cuban Missile Crisis. He mentions being on airborne nuclear alert.
Jeez. Imagine that pressure. Going from potentially flying fighters to sitting on nuclear alert in a B-52.
Exactly. It really shows you how, you know, careers can take unexpected turns in the military. You got to be adaptable.
So 5 years of that, and then he changes course again.
Yep. Then he gets into test pilot school at Edwards in 65. Highly competitive stuff.
Edwards, right. The right stuff kind of place.
Pretty much. Then flight test pilot at Wright-Patterson. And finally, with Vietnam heating up, August 68, he gets the assignment. A-1s out of NKP.
NKP Nakhon Phanom in Thailand.
That's the one.
Yeah.
So quite a journey before he even gets to the Skyraider.
Okay, so he arrives at NKP. Who is he with?
He travels with three other pilots. He mentions Sam Flowers, Bob Keith, and Rich Rose. They land, go through jungle survival school real quick.
Standard procedure, I guess.
Right. Then they get split up. Rich and Bob head over to the 62nd Squadron.
And Gordy.
He and Sam Flowers get assigned to the first Special Operations Squadron, the Hobos.
The Hobos.
Oh, okay.
And they jumped right into missions.
Almost immediately, he talks about doing these swoop flights.
Swoop flights. What were those?
Basically, dropping gravel mines onto the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Gravel mines. Not explosive?
No, no, just gravel. The idea was it would trigger these sensors hidden along the trail. Acoustic seismic sensors.
Ah, clever. So they'd know when trucks were moving.
Exactly. The sensors would send signals back, often relayed by other aircraft, letting them know about enemy movement. Pretty high tech for the time, in a way.
Fascinating. Using gravel for intel.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the only thing happening, right? There was something else brewing in Laos.
Right. Things were heating up in northern Laos. Ambassador Sullivan wanted air support for General Vang Pao, who was fighting the Path at Lao.
And the existing squadrons couldn't cover it. Or wasn't it their main focus?
It seems like a specific need arose that required a dedicated, maybe more flexible approach. This led directly to forming a new small unit.
Into the Zorros.
Precisely. The original group was tiny. Just Gordy, Sam Flowers, Bob Keith, Rich Rose, the four guys who arrived together, essentially, and their commander, Lieutenant Colonel Bob Casey.
And they started small, you said. Like, really small.
Get this. Their first operation center was literally a refrigerator truck.
You're kidding? A fridge truck?
Nope. That was their starting point. Really paints a picture of needing to be, you know, resourceful from day one.
No kidding. Resourceful is one word for it. And they adapted their planes, too.
Yeah, they painted their A-1s for nighttime operations. That became their main thing, especially in Laos.
Flying at night over Laos. What were they primarily using?
Mostly napalm and marking devices, rockets, CBUs, bombs too. But a lot of night work finding targets and marking them, often using flares dropped by other aircraft like C-123 candlesticks or O-2s.
And the schedule. He mentioned it was intense.
Unbelievably so. He describes flying basically from dusk till dawn, 5:40 p.m. to 5:30 a.m. shifts, night after night.
That is relentless. The physical and mental toll must have been immense.
Absolutely. Just the fatigue alone, let alone the constant danger.
Where were they mainly operating? He mentioned specific areas, right?
Yeah, the Barrel Roll area of Laos, parts of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and an area called Steel Tiger. All very active, very dangerous zones.
And their role wasn't just dropping bombs?
No, quite varied. Sometimes they were fast air controllers or FACs, so they'd find the targets and guide in the faster jets, the fast movers.
Acting as eyes in the sky.
Exactly. Or they'd worked directly with the slower observation planes, the O-2s or those C-123 candlestick flare ships, to find and hit targets themselves.
Using all sorts of ordnance, you mentioned. Napalm, CBUs, rockets, bombs.
Whatever the situation called for. And the sheer number of missions. Gordy flew over 200 missions in his one-year tour.
200 combat missions.
And logged around 800 combat hours. That's an incredible amount of time under fire in just 1 year. Really speaks to the intensity.
So even with this crazy operational tempo, the Zorro squadron actually grew.
It did. They eventually got their own dedicated building for operations and even their own living quarters, their hooch.
A step up from the fridge truck, I imagine.
Definitely. And Gordy tells this great little story. They shared a courtyard area with the 62nd guys, the Sandys, who flew search and rescue cover.
The Fireflies, right.
Well, Sandys for Fireflies were another A1 mission. Oof. But yeah, the 62nd. Anyway, the Zorros decided they needed their own by God pooch, like their own little officer's club or hangout spot.
Huh. Build in some normalcy.
Totally. They scrounged materials, even talked some army engineers building a road nearby into giving them an ice machine. You gotta love the initiative.
And an ice machine in the jungle, that's priceless. Yeah. It really shows that need for community, doesn't it?
It does. And that leads right into the whole party suit thing he talks about.
Yes, the brightly colored flight suits. What was the deal with those?
It was a fighter squadron tradition, apparently. A way to build camaraderie, celebrate things. Each unit had its own color.
So the Zorros had blue.
Blue for the Zorros, yeah. And he mentions the Hobos. His first squadron had greenish ones. The Sandy Sar guys wore a kind of yellowish orange. And the Jolly Green helicopter crews wore green.
So you could tell who was who at the bar, basically.
Pretty much. He said they'd wear them for special occasions, reunions later on. He even jokes about whether he can still fit into his.
It sounds like more than just party wear, though. Like it symbolized something more.
Oh, for sure. It was about unit identity, belonging, a way to kind of decompress, maybe step outside the high-stress pilot role for a bit and just be, you know, part of the team.
That team aspect, the camaraderie, seems huge in his story.
It really is. He compares it to being on a really tight-knit sports team, like maybe a football team where everyone relies on each other physically and mentally.
That intense bond.
Yeah. And he emphasizes how important reunions are for veterans. It's a chance to reconnect with the only other people who truly understand what you went through.
Finding that level of connection after leaving the military must be tough.
He touches on that. He says it's hard to find anything quite like it in civilian life. That shared experience under extreme pressure creates something unique.
How did he find adjusting back to life after that year?
He felt fortunate, actually. He credits his supportive family, but also the environment back at Edwards Air Force Base.
Back to test piloting.
Yeah. And a lot of the guys there were also veterans, many from Vietnam. So there was this built-in understanding, that shared background. It provided a kind of support network.
That must have helped immensely.
He thinks so. But he does acknowledge, you know, that it wasn't easy for everyone. Some guys really struggled with the transition back home. A serious issue for sure.
Definitely. Let's talk about the plane itself, the A1 Sky Raider. What were Gordy's thoughts on actually flying it? It wasn't his first aircraft type.
No, and it was different. He mentions it being his first real experience with a tail dragger, since most Air Force planes he'd flown had nose wheels.
Ah, the tail wheel configuration. Tricker to handle on the ground, right?
Can be, yeah. And he points out a specific difference. In training at Hurlburt Field, they were taught three-point landings. But in Thailand, standard practice was wheel landings.
Just touching down on the main wheels first. Why the difference?
He doesn't explicitly say why, but likely due to runway conditions, crosswinds, or maybe just operational tempo. Wheel landings can offer a bit more control in some situations.
And the cockpit itself. Not exactly high-tech, was it?
Oh, definitely not by today's standards. He emphasizes how basic it was. Needle, ball, airspeed indicator, your fundamental flight instruments, maybe a VOR for navigation, but that was about it.
So no fancy GPS or moving maps?
Nope, just raw piloting skills, and then throw in the weather. Southeast Asian monsoons, flying through severe thunderstorms in that thing must have been something else.
Demanding doesn't even begin to cover it.
Absolutely. It required exceptional skill and nerve.
Yet, despite the challenges, he respected the plane.
Immensely. He calls it absolutely terrific and superior for the close air support and rescue escort missions they were doing. It could carry a huge load, loiter for a long time, and take a beating.
A real workhorse.
Exactly. But he does mention a sad part. Because of pilot shortages, some newer guys were rushed into the A1 without maybe enough experience on type or in those conditions.
And that led to problems.
Tragically, yes. He mentions a couple of new pilots were lost during takeoff and thunderstorms right there at NKP, just overwhelmed by the combination of a demanding plane and extreme weather.
That's rough. Really highlights the risks involved, even outside direct combat.
It does. But on the flip side, he talks about the missions that made it all worthwhile.
The rescues.
Yeah. For him, successfully supporting a rescue mission, saving someone's life, he says that was the absolute best part. You can hear the satisfaction in his voice when he talks about it in the interview.
Helping guys on the ground who are about to be overrun.
Exactly. He said there was just no better feeling than pulling someone out of a really bad spot. Huge emotional impact.
Did he ever meet the people they rescued?
Interestingly, no. Not at the time. But he mentions meeting their spouses and kids years later at reunions.
Wow. That must have been powerful, seeing the families of the people whose lives they saved.
Yeah, a very real, tangible connection to the impact they had, even if delayed by years.
He also flew other types of missions, right? Supporting special ops teams.
That's right. While he was with the Hobos, before the Zorros formed, he flew on prairie fire missions.
Prairie fire. Those are the SOG missions. Studies and Observations Group.
Yep. Supporting those very high-risk operations where small teams, often Green Berets, were inserted deep into enemy territory. Extremely dangerous work for everyone involved.
He tells a story about the pilots and the Green Berets, doesn't he?
He does. It's about the mutual respect, but also how each group thought the other group was completely crazy for the risks they took.
Huh. The A1 guys flying low and slow, drawing fire, and the SOG guys operating on the ground miles from anywhere. Both incredibly dangerous jobs.
Exactly. A sort of shared understanding of operating right on the edge.
And one last detail, the Zorro name itself, where did that actually come from?
It wasn't original to their squadron. Gordy explains it actually came from an earlier T-28 pilot at NKP named Jack, who was known as the original Zorro.
So they revived the name.
Yeah, kind of adopted it to honor that earlier pilot and the spirit he represented when their A1 detachment formed for those last missions.
A bit of history there. He even tells a funny story about that original Zorro, Jack.
Yeah, a last man flying anecdote. Just highlights that humor and camaraderie that seemed so vital in getting through it all. Sounds like Jack was quite the character.
Okay, so wrapping this up, thinking back on Gordy Fornell's account from that interview,
What
really stands out?
Well, for me, it's the sheer intensity of it all. The demanding flying, the constant danger, the unique environment of NKP. But also just how critical that camaraderie was, that Zorro spirit building something together from basically nothing.
Yeah, the resourcefulness, a bond formed under fire. And his perspective on the A1 itself, basic, challenging, but incredibly effective for its job. It gives you a real appreciation for those pilots.
Definitely. His firsthand story really brings that specific slice of aviation history to life.
Yeah.
You get a sense of the person behind the missions.
Absolutely. It's a testament to the courage, the skill, and again, that deep connection between those who serve together in such extreme circumstances. Maybe for you listening, hearing Gordy's story sparks something.
Maybe you want to learn more about the A1 Starrator itself. It's a fascinating aircraft.
Or perhaps dig into more personal accounts from pilots who flew in Vietnam. There are so many stories, so many perspectives from that era still waiting to be fully understood and appreciated. It's a complex piece of history, that's for sure.